So thank you, the three of you, for coming. So I would like to tell you about what was the title I gave? I probably only gave Kevin the title anyway. The title was Higher Algebraic Closures. And I probably mentioned something like phases of matter. And some of what I'm going to say, everything is work in progress. And some is joint with Davide. And some is joint with Mike Hopkins. Okay, so the story I want to tell really begins in the 17th century with the following. Well, it was, let's see, it was conjectured in 1608 by, and then again in 1629. Let's see, I have to look up names. 1608 was by Roth, and 29 was by Girard.
I'm not here to complain if you get it wrong.
And the theorem itself was first given a complete proof in 1613, sorry, 1713, by Argand, and then again in a couple years later by Gauss. And Gauss had given an incomplete proof a few years before Argand gave the complete proof. And it's the fundamental theorem of calculus. Or sorry, fundamental theorem of algebra. I misspoke. So what does the fundamental theorem of algebra say? You can formulate it in many ways, but I want to present it this way. I want to say that among finite dimensional commutative R algebras, the complex numbers is distinguished by the following two properties. First of all, it's a field, meaning that if A is any non-zero commutative R algebra, then every morphism from C to A is an injection. And second of all, C is algebraically closed, which is one way to say that is that if A is a non-zero finite dimensional, actually it's enough for part one to also test against finite dimensional R algebras. If A is not a non-zero finite dimensional commutative R algebra, then there exists a map from A to C.
I have a quibble about dates.
Did I get
was
them?
Born in 1777.
I wrote them down correctly and misremembered them. Yeah, it should have been more like 150 years, almost 200 years, sorry. I got the ones digits right. Thank you. 200, it took 200 years to prove this theorem. And if you look on Wikipedia, there's a long discussion of like Descartes conjecturing that it's false, that kind of thing. Well, okay, I'm going to jump ahead a couple hundred years further because the next step in my story is from 2002, and it's a theorem of Delene's. And this is not the way Delene said it, but I want to write it this way to make it parallel with the way that I've presented the fundamental theorem of algebra. This is Delene's, what's called the existence of fiber functors. And the theorem is that among, let's say, I'll write finite dimensional, and conveniently, any reasonable way that you might want to make sense of finite dimensional, the theorem will be true. Symmetric monoidal are linear categories. The category of complex supervector spaces is distinguished by 1, if A is not 0, symmetric monoidal, R linear category, then every map from supervector spaces to A is faithful, which is to say it's injective on morphisms, and it's injective on isomorphism classes of objects. It's right on pi 0, on isomorphism classes of objects. I should write that up. Iso classes objects. And second of all, if you have a non-zero finite dimensional symmetric monoidal R linear category, then there exists a map from A to complex supervector spaces. So I hope you can see where I want to suggest that this story should repeat itself, that for every n, you should be able to have a similar thing. So for example, well, Mike and I are trying to prove the following. Is that among two categories, R linear two categories, you get these conditions, the algebraic closure. So I mean, what does this say? This is saying C is the algebraic closure of R in the zero categorical sense. I want to say this is saying that supervector spaces is the algebraic closure of R in some one categorical sense. So among two categories, the similar properties for the two category of complex superalgebras. And more generally, I want to suggest that this holds for some version of infinity categories.
What happens if you use finite fields?
It's a great question. It's a beautiful question. I don't want to linger too long, but I can't resist answering it now that you've asked. So already in characteristic zero, all we can do is conjecture the answer. And already for two categories and for three categories, I don't even know how to present proposed closure. In finite characteristic, nobody knows whether there is an algebraic closure, but proposed answers have been constructed. So when Victor Ostrich has constructed a family, he didn't write it in terms of algebraic closures, but it's equivalent. So Ostrich has constructed has proposed what I'll call the one categorical algebraic closures. Of the finite fields for odd primes. And they form a sort of systematic family in all cases. So when P is 3, it's again just supervector spaces. When P is more than is 5 or more, it's a completely inseparable extension of supervector spaces. And in general, what his proposed answer, he described it in terms of the characteristic P representation theory of the cyclic group of order P. It has another description as the following. You can take the quantum group SU2. We'll take the quantum group SU2 at Q, a pth root of unity. In characteristic P, the equation presenting a primitive pth root of unity completely ramifies, and so you get a symmetric monoidal category. And so this is actually this is symmetric monoidal in characteristic P. And that's Ostrich's proposed answer. But Ostrich and Eddinghoff and some of their collaborators are working on proving an equivalent statement for that. And for P equals 2, there's a beautiful construction to Dedalene. as a proposed answer. So the SU2 at level 2 minus 2 is not a very good thing to write down. So that's the best I can tell you in positive characteristic. We don't know. So the main conjecture that I want to suggest, I'm not actually quite ready to state the main conjecture. This was really part one, or part, maybe I'll call it part A, of the fundamental theorem of algebra. There's a second part of the fundamental theorem of algebra, which says that the automorphism group of C, the R-linear automorphisms of C, this is of course the Galois group of C, is a copy of Z mod 2. And the map from R to C is Galois, meaning that there's a canonical map from R to the Z mod 2 fixed points of C, and that's an equivalence, an isomorphism. And more generally, you have all of Galois descent. The Z mod 2 fixed points, you take any C linear problem, it's Z mod 2 fixed points under complex conjugation is the corresponding R linear problem. Similarly, the automorphism, well, I'll just write the Galois group. The Galois group of supervector spaces over R is isomorphic to Z mod 2 times BZ mod 2. BZ mod 2 is a group object in groupoids. And, well, let me say it this way. If you take vector spaces over R and map them to supervector spaces over C, the Galois fixed points, again, that's an equivalence of categories. So,
one is complex conjugation and priority reversal.
I'm sorry?
Complex conjugation and priority reversal.
That's right. That's exactly right. So this is complex conjugation of Z mod 2 and priority reversal is the BZ mod 2 part. So the conjecture that I want, the main conjecture I want to propose is the same. There exists right now I'm going to write symmetric monoidal infinity category, but in a moment I'll unpack what I mean by that. The intuition is it's some sort of higher symmetric monoidal higher category. I should give it a name. Curly C. Distinguished by, which is, okay, an algebraic closure is not really finite dimensional in general. Algebraic closures in general are infinite dimensional. It's an infinite dimensional. Which is distinguished by, again, every map from C to any other symmetric monoidal infinity category, whatever that will mean in a moment, is injective on isoclasses of objects that have every dimension. So I'll just say on homotopy. And second of all, for every finite dimensional symmetric monoidal infinity category, there exists a map from A to C, so that C is a field and it's algebraically closed. The second part of the conjecture is that the Galois group of this algebraic closure for R is the infinite orthogonal group. So I want to spend a little bit of time telling you what I mean when I, you know, what infinite dimensional commutative algebra looks like. I mean, infinite categorical dimensional commutative algebra. There's sort of various types of infinity of infinite dimension, infinite categorical things. There's something that goes under the name infinity category among people who are somehow connected to Lurie, which is a sort of homotopical notion of one category. It's really one categorical, but it has homotopical spaces worth of morphisms rather than sets. That's not what I mean. Another thing I don't mean is you could have something with objects, morphisms, two morphisms, and so on infinitely up. So like the Bordism categories or things like that, they have morphisms that have every dimension. The thing I mean is something that goes down. So if you think about the relationship between the complex numbers and the supervector spaces over C, the complex numbers live as the morphisms in supervector spaces. Supervector spaces is a delooping of complex numbers, is one way to say that. And that's the notion that I want to formalize. So, the definition. I think it's going to be a very useful definition. So, I want to say this. I'd like to ask for some adjectives in a moment, but first I'm going to just say maybe the sort of symmetric monoidal thing. So let me say a pre-tower called that C, so I'll call this A, consists of the following data. A pre-tower is going to be some type of symmetric monoidal infinitely categorical object. So it should consist of a sequence An, where each, sort of for each, yeah, should consist of a bunch of things, An, where An is a weak N category. So I have a weak N category for every N, like the complex numbers would be my zero category, the supervector spaces would be my one category. Each AN should be equipped with a distinguished object. Sort of a unit object. And then the last condition I want is that if you take the, I'll write it loops AN, so by that I mean the endomorphisms in the N category AN of the unit object, I want that to be equipped with an equivalence to an minus 1. That's the data of a pre-tower. It's something like an omega spectrum. It's writing two sideways. Omega spectrum in the sense of algebraic topology. So what's happening here? Well, if I just had two terms, I have a category with a distinguished object, and the endomorphisms of that object are automatically a monoid. And so the category one below has a monoidal structure. If, as I go higher and higher, what happens is that you get more and more commutativity. That in general, what this forces that every AN is it's an infinite loop space. It's a commutative object. And that's not quite good enough. I want to impose some linearity conditions. So let me say a tower over R is this data, a pre-tower. And I'd like each AN to be R linear. Everyone is R linear. By which I mean all spaces of the every set of N morphisms in AN is of an R vector space. All compositions are correctly linear. And then the last thing I'd kind of like to ask for, that's it's a convenience, but I think it's a really important one, is I'd like to ask that every that each an should be closed, should contain all of its absolute colimits. Or absolute limits. I'd like to tell you a little bit about absolute limits to explain why I want this condition and why it's a really natural condition if you're doing linear algebra. But that's the end of the definition.
You don't require that it's generated in some sense by this distinguished object?
No, absolutely not. I don't want to because supervector spaces is not generated in any sense by its unit object. Also, C is not the span of the number 1 over the real numbers. Oh, I should probably, I said this, I just erased this, everything's work in progress. Let me tell you some of the things I don't know yet. I'll give you some ideas of what they might be. But I'll just warn, for instance, this is not a very satisfying definition of field, because I'll tell you in a moment, as I'll explain in a moment, the real numbers are not a field in this sense. So I would like a better, I actually think the conjecture is correct as stated, I just don't think I have a good definition of what field means. And I don't have a completely satisfying definition of what finite dimensional means. I have a definition that, well, as I'll say in a moment, I think picks out not the algebraic closure, but the separable closure. And in positive characteristic, we know that separable and algebraic closures might be very different. So, let me tell you a little bit about absolute colimit, or absolute limits. I'm going to tell them to you by example. So absolute limits are a beautiful story that's a fairly classical story in category theory, at least in one category theory, and is the main topic of Laveyre's thesis, and has a beautiful unpacking. And the standard words are Cauchy completion and Caruby envelope. So I'll just write those if you want to look them up. But I'll just do it by example, first of all. So suppose you have just an ordinary category. Let me not be in higher categories. Let's say C was a terrible choice to use for my algebraic closure, because I like C to just be a category. Let me call this something else. I can't handle. We'll call this R. It's supposed to be a curly R. Sorry, I just have to be able to write let C be a category. So say C is a one category. An idempotent in C is a very basic notion. It's an object together with an endomorphism of that object, which squares to itself. It's a projection on a Hilbert space, for example. And then the fascinating fact is that if you have an idempotent in C, so given an idempotent in C, that might be all you have. You might just have a single object with an idempotent and nothing else, and then you're stuck. There's nothing you can do. But it might happen that the limit of this diagram exists. Actually, that might happen if and only if the colimit of the same diagram exists, because they both exist if and only if they're equal. They're canonically isomorphic. The limit and colimit of this diagram are canonically isomorphic. And in both cases, the limit and colimit, if it exists, let me call it y. So they're equal. I mean, they either both exist or they don't. By this, I mean that if one exists, so does the other. And in general, testing whether something's a limit or colimit is a complicated thing. You have to test against all other objects. But finding out if you're the limit or colimit of an idempotent is a really easy thing. You don't have to test against other objects. So this y exists. Such a y will solve that I is the same as a way of factoring. I had x. Well, if you have such a y, it's the same as having a, you'll always have a projection from x onto y and an injection of y into x, such that if you go down and back up, you get the original idempotent f. And if you go up and then down, you get the identity on y. So finding out if you have a limit or colimit of this diagram is a totally easy thing. You just have to solve some equations. You don't have to test anything. You have to solve these equations, and that's equivalent to finding a limit or colimit. So a corollary of this, a corollary of the fact that it, being a limit or colimit is this just algebraic notion, is that if any functor, if y exists, if y is an object of my original category, I mean, if the limit exists in my category, and f is any functor, let me say it this way. If the limit of this diagram exists, and f is any functor, then f of the limit is the limit of f. So limits over idempotents are preserved by all functors. And that's what I mean by absolute. So in general, an absolute limit, a limit is absolute if it's of a shape preserved by all functors, if it is preserved by all functors. And absolute limits always have this property that the limit and colimit of the same diagram agree, and they're always given by equations. Let me tell you another example, which is that if you're in an R-linear world, okay, so actually, if you think a moment, and one of Lavier's major observations was that this notion of absolute limit, it's actually dependent on what type of category you're working with. If I'm working with R-linear categories, then I should only test against R-linear functors. So another example is that in the world of linear categories, actually it's enough to be additive, but I'll say linear categories, direct sum, finite direct sums, are also absolute. Because again, a finite direct sum, it's a coproduct of two vector spaces, it's a product of two vector spaces, and to test whether your direct sum is just some equations. You need some projections, you need to solve some equations. And the basic well-known fact is that if C is a linear category, which is closed for finite direct sums and splittings of idempotents, then it is closed for all absolute limits. The other basic fact is that it's really easy to take any category you have and close it under absolute limits. If C is any category, any, say, linear category, you can close it under limits in a systematic way. You enclose it for absolute limits easily. The easiest, the shortest way to do it is two steps. You first form what's called the matrix category of C, where the objects are finite lists of objects in C, and the morphisms are matrices of morphisms. And then you take what's called the Kurubi envelope of that. An object of the Kurubi envelope is an idempotent in your original category. So you just add some formal symbols that will be the new objects, and writing down the morphisms between them is similarly systematic. So I claim that these basic facts all generalize. Let me tell it to you in a two category. Well, in full generality, I haven't proven that I have a complete list of absolute limits. But I think I know the complete list. I'll tell it to you in a two category first. So in a two category, I'll give you sort of the two categorical generalization of idempotents. Davide and I call these condensations. It's a joint with Davide Gaiolo. A condensation is, well, it's an should be have an object and an endomorphism. And now I'm in a two category. So I'm trying to generalize, I'm trying to categorify the notion of being an idempotent. So instead of having, so I could look at F squared and I can look at F. And now these are both endomorphisms of X, so they're both objects in a one category. And I'll say that I have, and a split surjection. Of F squared onto F. What do I mean by split surjection? I mean this. This is a split surjection of x onto y. And then finally, such that, well, there's an associativity condition. You can, there, that gives you two different, you get two different split surjections. I'll just say associativity. From this split surjection, you can form two different split surjections of f cubed onto f squared, and then split surject again onto f. I want those to all be the same. So, a little claim theorem. Condensations. Are absolute in the sense that forming the corresponding condensate, taking the limit of a condensation, limits of condensations, I'll call these condensates, are preserved by all functors.
Presumably, you have some algebraic formula for looking at it.
Yeah.
Is it too complicated? Is anything better?
It's very similar to having a split surjection. I have projections and injections and so on, and all the time. Let's see. It's a projection and an injection so that you have an isomorphism here and a split surjection here. That's what the condensate looks like. So the only difference is that this part becomes a split surjection of the composition onto the identity. I don't know a good notation for split surjection. If I knew one, I would write it. This is the part I haven't proven, I believe. So before I write the belief, let me say we have a pretty good understanding of what condensations mean in all dimensions. You can keep weakening this where you have sort of in a three category, I could have an endomorphism which condenses. The square should condense to the identity, and then some associativity conditions. So my belief is that among linear n categories, if you are closed, the same thing, that the complete list of, if you have condensates and direct sums, then you have all absolute limits. Conjecture, if you will. I haven't done the details yet. So what's a typical example? Well, the most basic construction that people do with Kurubi envelopes in a lot of the world is the following. If you take a ring, say an R algebra, I'll only care about the commutative case, but what I'm about to say will make sense in any, even non-commutatively, say a commutative R algebra. Well, if you have a commutative R algebra, you can always form a category with only one object and that many endomorphisms. So you can form a category, a one category, an R linear one category that I'll call BA, which has one object. It's just a point. And the endomorphisms of the point in BA is just A itself. And if you take this very basic construction where I just take the category, suspend it by one, you know, put it in degree one, I take the object, put it in degree one, and if you then close this for absolute limits, remember I told you the closure of any category for absolute limits is you take the matrices and then you take the Kurubi envelope. This ends up being the finite dimensional, sorry, finitely generated projective A modules. And if A is commutative, then BA is automatically symmetric monoidal, and this is automatically symmetric monoidal. And you just get the notion of finitely generated projective modules. Now, an interesting fact is that you can take finitely generated projective modules, and finitely generated projective modules embeds into all modules. And the finitely generated projective modules are actually exactly the dualizable modules in the sense of the Bordesen hypothesis. This is the A mod that's called fully dualizable in the sense of Bordesen hypothesis. Let me give a name for this construction. Well, car of mad is just closure for absolute limits. And I'll call this whole thing where you first suspend something by putting it up by one and putting a point at the bottom and close for absolute limits. I think a very convenient name for this would be sigma A, because it's the thing that really plays the role of suspension in the story. So here's a neat fact. Davide and I have proven that if you take A a commutative R algebra, the fact I'm saying R algebra is immaterial. If you suspend it twice in this sense, so if you take this category, make it into a two category with only one object, and then close for absolute limits. This is the two category. This is a symmetric monoidal two category just from construction. Which one is it? It's the two category of finite dimensional separable A algebras. which is to say, by, I guess, Christian Rapprice's thesis, this is the two category of fully dualizable A algebras. Fully dualizable, I mean, in the bi-category of A algebras. Finite dimensional separable A algebras and bimodules. And, well, I believe that this story continues. I expect that any reasonable definition of what finite dimensional A linear N category is, kind of sigma N of A, is the fully dualizable, fully dualizable. Maybe I'll say this is an expectation. This is either a definition or it's a theorem, I'm not sure. Fully dualizable A linear, maybe A vector, Well, I'll just write it for R. There's a lot of work on what's called N vector spaces. What I really mean is if you go and inspect the literature, half a dozen people have presented half a dozen different definitions of what a finite dimensional N vector space might be. And at least for low N, you can just compare them, and they're all the same, and they're all this one. So, let me mention a couple, let's see, so I just wanted to say I owe you why this is called a condensation. Maybe I won't try to unpack that because I want to tell you about Galois theory instead. But very, very roughly, it's that, maybe I'll even say it. So what Davide Gaiotto and I explain how to do, the reason to justify the name condensation is that we do two things. So very roughly, what we do is, given any object in the, I could do this over any commutative ring. If you take the n linear, the n categorical suspension of A in this sense, and take an object in it, then we give you back, we can build, give prescriptions, we build an n-dimensional phase of matter, topological matter. By n, I mean n minus 1 plus 1, dimensional phase of matter. We actually give it as a commuting projector Hamiltonian. And it's a very nice type of phase of matter. It's a phase of matter that admits gapped boundary. Maybe gapped topological matter. And conversely, well, how would you ever try to study a piece of material? You have some material, like a piece of chalk or something like that. You want to understand what type of matter is this. One of the ways you might try to study what type of matter this is you might try to take your piece of matter, and you might try to slice it very thin, into very thin slices. And if your slices are very, very thin, then each individual slice might be behaving like a phase of matter in one dimension low. And you could try to understand your whole, your seven-dimensional phase of matter as a stack of six-dimensional phases of matter, plus how those six-dimensional matters interact. This is a terrible method in general, because in general, six-dimensional matter is complicated. It's at least as complicated as seven-dimensional matter. How thick your slices are might have some, might affect things. And when you actually did that slicing, you introduced some user, your own choices. You had to break some bonds and how you broke those bonds might have affected the answer. So in general, this slicing procedure is a terrible system. You could, in principle, understand your seven-dimensional matter, but you have too much data, too much redundancy. But if you have n-dimensional matter, have n-dimensional gapped matter, which is gapped topological, this is a gapped topological matter. Gapped topological matter means that at least at very low temperatures, things like, say, it behaves like a topological field theory. At very low temperatures, gapped topological matter, like if you have a slab, it doesn't matter how thick the slab is. So if you have n-dimensional gapped topological matter, which admits a gapped topological boundary condition? There's plenty of gapped matter that's gapped in the bulk but does not admit a gapped boundary condition. But if it does admit a gapped boundary condition, gapped topological matter, which admits a gapped boundary condition, then using the gapped boundary condition, we can give you, we can write a corresponding condensation for it. So your original phase of matter lives in the space of condensates of n minus one dimensional matter, gapped matter. I mean, there's a category of gapped matter with gapped defects and so on. And so if you can iterate this, if you can keep cutting into lower and lower codimensions, always staying gapped topological, then we're exactly getting the space of a linear matter.
Something part of your procedure would be that if I take the topological boundary condition and I glue it to itself, I can deform it to the identity.
That's right.
Why is that?
Well, I'm not gluing it to itself. I'm gluing it to its dual.
Oh.
The typical picture is you might have your gapped matter here with its boundary condition, and you might have this same matter here with kind of the boundary condition rotated.
So it's the same boundary condition, just rotated.
Yeah, and then you can certainly give yourself. So here's a picture of an adiabatic. I mean, this is not a. There's a, this. If you take time flowing this way, then here's a map from x with some boundary condition to two copies of x with some boundary condition. It's not a gapped map. These are not in the same gap. Two copies of x is not in the same gapped phase as x, but it is an adiabatic map. So it takes ground states to ground states. And so this is the typical picture of like this should look like a like part of a condensation. Here's the, or if I run time down, then this would be a map from x tensor x down to x. So it's part of the data of a condensation structure on x. But yeah, I mean you can do this adiabatically, and that's the point. That's why we call it gapped. So I think I owe you, what else do I owe you? Well, I want to tell you a little bit about connections to some topology. And then I think I'm probably, that'll probably be where I end. So I've probably long ago erased it. Let me remind my main conjecture. So recall the main conjecture was, well, part A said there exists an infinite dimensional tower that I think I decided would be called curly R because I tried to call it curly C and that didn't work. Distinguished by something, and it was an R linear tower. And the second part of the conjecture was that the Galois group, let me say it, now I can really say it precisely. What I really want to say is I said the Galois group of this R over R, of curly R over R is O infinity. And I might have forgotten to write this, but I want to say and this extension is Galois. And now I can just tell you what I specifically mean by that. What I mean is, if you take this infinite algebraic closure and take its fixed points for the Galois group, well, by construction, you will receive a map from the kind of the suspension spectrum of R. And I want to claim that that's an equivalence. That's what I mean by being Galois. So I have this systematic way. I've been using it already, that you can take any commutative ring and make a tower out of it just by continually suspending in this sense. That's what I mean by Galois. So you know, we have lots of words in mathematics for things that we haven't proven yet, but that we think are true, like belief and conjecture and so on. Here's one that maybe deserves the name pre-theorem, because I think I know how to prove it, but I haven't done the details yet. If you take any, if A is any finite dimensional tower, well, you can look at all the maps from A to R. By assumption, that's non-empty. You can take its set of connected components. This is some topological, you know, some homotopy type, some groupoid, infinite groupoid. You can take its connected components, and I believe that that will be equal to the maps from just the zero space of this tower, I mean the zero morphisms, the things that live at the top, to R0, and R0 is just C. And a corollary of this is that, well, if you take this algebraic closure, you could take its invertibles, invertible objects at every dimension, invertible morphisms, I mean, and that will be isomorphic, well, equivalent. So this is automatically a spectrum. It has just a space at every dimension, a space of invertible objects. It's an omega spectrum. And I claim it will be equivalent to the Brown-Kamenetz dual to spheres. So this is the sphere spectrum. And this is the Brown-Kamenetz dual. In particular, the homotopy groups, they're all in negative degree. So the group of invertible objects in the nth space of this, write it that way, is the maps from the nth homotopy group of spheres. C cross, it's the Pontryagin dual to the homotopy groups of spheres. And that just comes from taking this pre-theorem and testing sort of group algebras in. And so that, well, then if you, so at least if the conjecture is true, that helps to explain why in condensed matter there's been this prevalence of cobordism spectra. So because, for example, if I take the O infinity fixed points of the algebraic closure, I'm claiming I get just the real numbers, or rather its suspension spectrum. Or if I take the SO infinity fixed points, well, the difference between O and SO is just a Z mod 2 acting by complex conjugation. So that would be the complex numbers, and so on. And so the corollary is that, for example, the invertible phases in the real sense is the Brown-Kamenetz dual to unoriented cobordism. The complex invertible phases, you get the Brown-Kamenetz dual to oriented cobordism, and so on. And it, since this is some, I mean, taking invertible objects in the space of phases is a very common thing people do in condensed matter. It goes under the name kind of studying SPT phases or short-range entangled phases. So this is supposed to explain why you're seeing cobordism spectra in that way. So I think I should stop. It's a corollary of a conjecture. I'm not sure if that deserves to be called a corollary.
I have a mostly unrelated selfish question.
Yeah.
Which is there a good word for this process of taking a category and adding all the absolute limits?
Laver would call it the Cauchy completion. That's certainly what the n-category lab calls it. I actually think I almost want to just say you should call it the Kurubi envelope.
That's what the mirror symmetry community calls
right.
it.
So, I mean, I think the question is whether, so some people say Kurubi envelope only for the procedure of closing for idempotence.
Right.
And some people, I mean, if you already have all your direct sums, and if you only care about linear categories, then the only thing left to do is take this close for idempotence. Laver was thinking about very different worlds. So the reason Laver called it Cauchy completion was that you can do this for any type of enriched category. And Laver was quite taken with the fact that metric spaces themselves are an example of enriched category. They're enriched in the positive real numbers. In a metric space, instead of having a set of morphisms between two points, you have a real number worth of morphisms between two points. And if metric spaces are example, and then the triangle inequality is the fact that you can compose. It's the existence of composition. So what Laver explained was what Laver proved was that the closure for absolute limits in the sense of that I was explaining, if you work in the worlds of metric spaces, meaning categories enriched in the real numbers, is the Cauchy completion in the sense of metric spaces. And this was very exciting to him, and that's why he calls it Cauchy completion. And that feels very different from taking the Kurubi envelope.
So when you went to two categories, you just said it should be super algebras.
Yeah.
And you don't expect anything essentially new. So why?
Well,
what's the idea there?
So that would follow from my general conjecture, certainly. Because if I it's not too hard to argue. I mean, it's an easy just sort of a junction argument to say that if you asked for kind of the algebraic closure in the world of two categories, that would be the two space of this tower. And then so what do we know from, so if you believe the conjectures, so I want, so the two categorical algebraic closure, if you believe the conjectures, would be what I'm calling, you know, R2. It's the two space of the tower. And what I know is that I know that that if you take so I said one of the things I didn't emphasize but mentioned was that the inclusion of the real numbers into supervector spaces was a Galois extension. And the Galois group you can compute, and you know Galois groups always have this ratio. The absolute Galois groups is like the Galois group of the finite extension times the rest of the Galois group, or extended by the rest of the Galois group. And so what you find out is that the spin fixed points of the full algebraic closure is the kind of suspension spectrum of supervector spaces over C. And I want, but on the other hand, super algebras over C, that's just suspend. That's what you get when you, well, not all super algebras. I really should have said separable super algebras over C. I mean, and I said supervector space, but of course I really mean finite dimensional supervector space. Finite dimensional super algebras is what you get by suspending supervec once. by David in my calculation. And then the point is that spin infinity, its homotopy starts in degree 3.
Right. So you're saying it's because there's no pi 2.
That's right.
But in the next level, there should
in the next level, that's exactly right. So right, so yes, so the n was because pi 2 spin infinity equals 0, R2 is superalgebras. And then also because pi 3 is not 0, as you're anticipating, there's new things in R3.
Any ideas what they are?
I have some ideas. So what do I know? I know that there should be 24 invertible objects.
Of course.
because I know the homotopy groups of spheres in low degrees, or rather, you know, Adams knows the homotopy groups of spheres in low degrees. So I know there should be 24 objects. I know it has to receive a functor from the Bartles-Douglas-Henriquez 3 category.
Mm-hmm.
I mostly understand how O infinity is acting on the Bartles-Douglas-Henriquez 3 category. And the homotopy group in degree 3 of spin infinity, pi 3 of spin infinity, is acting by the central charge. So that gives me a lot of control over it. What I believe, I don't know if this is worth calling a conjecture yet, suspicion. So my suspicion is that the third space in this tower has a model in terms of whose objects are some type of conformal field theory, maybe super conformal field theories, but you know, say, or some type of two D chiral CFTs. Let me say already why I have a good reason for believing that. In general, I believe that Rn is something about, so I told you that these suspension towers that I get are like gapped matter that admits topological boundary. In general, I think that this algebraic closure is just the space of gapped matter, boundary conditions be damned. And if you ask a condensed matter theorist, they might tell you the following story. They might tell you that if you take 3D gapped matter and try to ask what boundary conditions it has, well, matter always has some boundary condition. It's just generally terrible. If you have gapped matter in dimension 3, you can start studying the boundary conditions. And a reasonable story that I don't think mathematicians can formalize is that if you run an RG flow on the boundary, you can flow it to a conformal field theory. But you can't flow it to a gapped theory on the boundary. So if you believe that, then you end up believing that all gapped matter in 3 dimensions admits chiral conformal boundary.
Well, you can explain chiral, but I can't.
Okay. Oh, okay, maybe chiral or anti.
If you had a mixture of chiral and anti-chiral, you could make it massive.
That's right. If I have a mixture of chiral and anti-chiral, I expect to be able to gap out the some part of that. And maybe I should, I mean, I said some type of, maybe I mean rational CFT. So that's why I think that R3 has a model whose objects are some type of CFT. And now you could ask, oh, but typically when I study things, I think that the central charge really means that is really sort of an integer grading or something like that. And I should really say something like the following. I think it has a model whose objects are some type of 2D CFT, but where the space of objects should be some sort of derived moduli space, that in the space of objects, supersymmetric twisting is an allowed path. So if two different CFTs are related by twisting, then I think they're in the same component of the space of objects. And in particular, I think that I think that some version of 24 fermions, or some orbifold of it, um, should admit a twisting to the trivial theory. So that's what I think is going on. So Jessica and I are looking for that twisting right now. Maybe in general, I'll also say that I think what's going on, I said I think that in general, Rn is the space of gapped n-dimensional matter, which you might be able to model in terms of boundary conditions if you want. And in general, so that of course, there should be the J homomorphism gives me a map from the homotopy groups of spheres. Using the J homomorphism, you can get a map from the homotopy groups of spheres, or rather the Poincaré-Ergun dual groups. So there's a map here from something like the dual of the homotopy groups of spheres. Of the orthogonal group. J homomorphism. And in dimensions n minus 3, when n is 4k minus 1, this is a copy of, sorry, I'm saying this wrong. Well, let me just say it in words. Using the J homomorphism, you can pick out distinguished cyclic groups inside of these homotopy groups. And I think those should be the cyclic groups of free fermions. Thank you for listening.